Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Corey Ally Knockreiner.
Ally.
Nothing to do with the podcast or the report. I'm just in a mood to be an ally for my friends out there.
All right, sounds good. What a swell guy. This quarter, like Corey just mentioned, it's time for us to have another special edition where we chat about the latest internet security report from WatchGuard Threat Labs. So let's go ahead and just jump on in. So it is the last week of the quarter, which I think it'll technically still be the last week of the quarter. Yes, it will when this episode comes out. Good. I'm not a liar. And that means that it is time to have another little special episode covering the findings from our latest internet security report from WatchGuard Threat Lab. So
pause for applause.
Yeah.
Oh. Woohoo, yay!
So if you somehow missed every single other podcast episode where we've talked about a security report, or you haven't seen our security reports before, I guess we should just start out by talking about what it is and what our goals are for it. Basically, we receive threat intelligence from our Firebox security appliances that are deployed across the world in this feed that we call the Firebox feed, along with a few other security services too. And once a quarter, we go through and aggregate and build a bigger picture of exactly what the threat landscape looks like based off of that intelligence that we get. We try and pull out trends. We try and pull out interesting individual malware payloads or network attacks that we see that are affecting our customer networks. And then it's not enough just to scare you. We always try and give you some good takeaways at the end, too, on how to defend against these threats. So this quarter is the latest. I think we've just passed like the 3-year mark now, I think, of doing these reports.
It's been a while.
It's been going on for quite some time. And in each report, we always try and add something new. I don't want to give it away quite yet, but we've got a really interesting bit of data in this report, too, that is making its first appearance as well.
And I think a lot of it comes from our new writers. You and I started this report, literally made it up as we went the first time, you know, decided to make up the sections. But now we have a lot of writers or analysts that are joining us, and a lot of their great new analysis and insights have added to the report over the years. New ways to look at some of the trends.
Yeah, agreed entirely. So before we get rolling through the report, if you want to see the whole thing, you can find it on watchguard.com/security-report. I think you need to put in an email address to get a copy of it, but outside that, you'll be able to download the whole report there, or at least just the executive summary, just to get the most important little tidbits from it.
It's also good to note that if they go to secplicity.org, to the threat landscape page, you have to scroll down a little bit, but if you want to see past reports, I think we showed the last year worth on one of the banners. Scroll down on that page a little bit.
Yep, exactly. So in this report, we started out with the Firebox feed, which is broken up into three main sections. Where we go over the malware threats, including big high-level trends and a bit of a deep dive into some individual payloads. Then we go into the network attacks, which are incidents from our Firebox's intrusion prevention service, so network-based attacks, and then malicious domains in our DNS analysis section, where we look at threat intel from our DNS watch tool, and where we can see malicious domains, phishing domains, compromised websites, and then go into individual ones the first time we see them and kind of point out exactly what they're trying to do and how they might affect your customers. And then at the end of the report, we finished up with the top security incident, which I don't want to spoil it quite yet, but basically we pick one big incident or trend from the quarter and kind of do a bit of a deep dive into how it affected the threat landscape for those 3 months. So I guess we can go ahead and start with the Firebox feed. And maybe we should start with a bit of a description, Corey, of like how we get the data.
Yeah, sure. So basically, our Firebox, our network security appliance, has a number of threat services or malware and security services protecting you. And basically, we don't use every single detail yet, but things like its malware protection. We have three different forms of malware protection. Gateway antivirus, which is kind of a more traditional antivirus, largely signature-based, with a little more heuristics and other things. But then we have our more advanced malware services that come with something we call Total Security. One is Intelligent AV, and that kind kind of uses machine learning to identify trends in a lot of the good and bad malware and goodware that we've seen over decades to predict what is bad more proactively, so it doesn't have to rely on waiting for a signature. And then our final one, kind of the last word in that network picture, is APT blocker. And APT blocker is a cloud sandbox, but ultimately it's behavioral analysis. It doesn't matter really how malware tries to change the way it looks on a digital level to get past signatures. When the malware actually runs on these systems, we can recognize it based on many different behaviors that are bad and suspicious. So one of the places we get the information is basically tracking the malware caught by all of these different services. That gives us a good idea of the trends and what types of attacks people are sending, and kind of how malware evades certain types of services versus being caught by others. Besides that, we also look at what we call network attacks. This is 100% driven by our intrusion prevention service. IPS obviously blocks network attacks, exploits. But no, if you don't know what a network exploit is, it can be any software vulnerability in a program that you know uses network connections or talks to other computers over a network. And one thing sometimes people mistake is they think only network servers, like it's only IIS or send mail or DNS that's being protected. But don't forget, actually IPS hits way more often on things like client-based network services. So your browser is actually going out to talk to a server, and IPS can also catch attacks that attack that client over the network. And also don't forget about web application attacks, which may not be a vulnerability in specific software, but they're usually a software development error in a web application, whether it's a framework that everyone uses or a custom-made web application. So IPS kind of powers our network attacks. And finally, a while back, we added information for DNS attacks. So we have a product called DNS Watch and DNS Watch Go. Basically DNS-based internet security. Anytime your users go to a site that might be it might be bad in any way. It could be malware distribution, phishing, botnet command and control domain, or a good site that's temporarily hijacked for one of those purposes. DNS Watch will record that URL. So we share a lot of information about the evil domains. And actually, I should say DNS Watch will block that domain. We have other products that can block the URL too. So anyways, because of that, we can also show you a lot of trends on the evil domains popping up around the internet every quarter.
So if you want to participate in the Firebox feed, it's all opt-in. It's under either the general settings or the global settings, depending on if you configure Firebox with the WatchGuard System Manager or the web UI. But there's a checkbox in there that says send device feedback to WatchGuard. And we get some telemetry that helps out product management, figure out what services are being used and help make improvements to the boxes that way. It's all anonymized. And what we look at is these incidents that are reported back anytime the appliance blocks one of these threats.
And I just wanted to say that we really highly hope that you do this, because not only is it beneficial to us to get this threat data, it ultimately is beneficial to you and the community. The more people reporting back to us, the more we can tell the threats that are passing. And we actually make product adjustments and decisions, and even the advice we give can be tuned to what's happening. So the more feedback we get, the better. And to Mark's anonymized point, just know that we share no personal information in our report. In fact, by the time we get the data we're looking at, really the only thing that can be close to personal information is at some point we know the IP address of your Firebox, but we never ever share that. We just use that, and in fact, usually we don't even see it if we can actually already get the geolocation data. But the only reason we use that one bit of information is to kind of regionalize some of these trends. So just feel comfortable that we're not trying to look into your private network. We're not seeing private traffic. We're literally just getting indicators of what different boxes are blocking and where they are in the world.
Exactly. And so for this last quarter, in quarter one of 2020, we had just over 44,000 fireboxes reporting in, which is like a 9% increase from the previous quarter. It's also an all-time high, but it's still only a small fraction of the number of fireboxes that we have out there.
Yeah, I'd say 10 or 11%. Do we probably have anywhere from 350 to 400,000 fireboxes out there? So while 44,000 is a huge, you know, a big statistically relevant example, we'd love to see more participating.
Yep. So if you do manage your own firebox, or if you have someone else managing it for you, please look into enabling that telemetry feature, that send device feedback to WatchGuard checkbox. If you want to know exactly what it's sending back, like I'm sure you probably do, you can check the product documentation. We list every bit of telemetry that's included in there. So moving on to the actual report itself, we should start with the malware section because it's first up in the report. And just from a high level, across the board, across the three anti-malware engines that Corey talked about earlier, detections were actually down for the quarter. I think the best, like in the report, we highlight the total volumes. They're like 21 million or so for GAV, 9 million or so for our IAV, and a bit more for APT blocker. When it comes to per box detections, though, on average, we blocked 489 hits per firebox for the gateway antivirus, so the legacy signature-based detections, 23 hits per firebox for intelligent AV, and 196 per firebox for APT blocker. Yeah.
And just to put that a little bit into context, it is definitely down quarter over quarter. But remember, Q1 was a record-setting quarter for malware. And I believe while it's a couple million down from that quarter, it's actually up year over year, if I remember.
Yes, it was.
So that decrease is probably a blip because of, I think you already said it, probably COVID working from home. But it still is quite high. So don't think that down necessarily means low on malware.
Yeah. And Corey just pointed out what our main takeaway from that was. Even though the number of reporting fireboxes coming in was up quite considerably, malware as a whole was down. And we really felt like it was safe to attribute that to the fact that about halfway through the quarter, most businesses ended up shifting their just about entire workforce to working remotely, which means that some of them might be VPNing in to get behind the perimeter, but the majority of them are probably outside the perimeter and not attributing to detections.
While we're talking about that, this might be a few quarters coming, but I just want to take the opportunity because we're so excited about it, just to remind the listeners, we just also got an endpoint security company here at WatchGuard. If you hear to Panda Security, they're a 30-decade-old endpoint security company with a really cool product.
30 decades old. That, 300-year-old security company.
That was my bad combination of 30 years and 3 decades. Thank you. A 3-decade-old security company. In any case, what I'm getting at is this, obviously, this work-from-home change means that there's going to be more focus on endpoint security or of course, network appliances you might have at home. But in the future, we hope to also include this endpoint view into our quarter as we continue to incorporate that acquisition.
Yeah, and especially with their 300 years of experience, even protecting settlers on the Oregon Trail.
I guess if we translated it to man years, I could still be accurate. I'm sure they have 300 or more man years of experience in the 30 decades of 500 plus people.
That sounds a lot
more 30,
accurate.
I said it again, the 3 decades. Now I'm going to say 30 decades every time.
You're stuck. Well done. Some of the other high-level trends that we look at every single quarter, one that you've probably heard us talk about several times on this podcast, is what we call the zero-day malware number. And we always try and give an explanation for this to soothe the ruffled feathers of people that don't like the zero-day name being used anywhere outside of zero-day exploits. So this is different than a unpatched vulnerability, a zero-day exploit. When we say zero-day malware, we're talking about malware that doesn't get caught by signature-based antivirus, meaning it doesn't have a signature. That could be because it's a brand new piece of malware, or it could be a pretty old piece of malware that attackers have just made evasive. Because there's tools that are out there on the dark web and even the not-so-dark web for free and for purchase that make it really easy for even unskilled cyber criminals to take a old malware payload, run it through these tools like packers and encryptors, and then make it evasive enough to get past signature-based detections. And in quarter one of this year, the zero-day malware number was 64%, which basically means that if you were relying just on signature-based detections, you're missing 64% of all malware that was out there, which is pretty substantial. One of the other new bits of data that we just added in this quarter, though, is something we've been tracking for about like a year and a half now, but it finally got to the point where we thought it was enough appliances reporting in to make this statistically relevant. But we've been starting to track of appliances that have TLS decryption enabled. So basically they're man-in-the-middling their own HTTPS connections to perform inspection. We started tracking threats that came over those decrypted connections that were originally protected by HTTPS. These days, I think the latest stats from Google is like 95, 97% of all internet traffic uses HTTPS. So it's quite substantial. And if you aren't decrypting traffic in your office environment, you're potentially missing a lot of threats. And we were finally able to put a number onto those percentage of missed threats. And in quarter one of this year, we found that 67% of all threats came in over a TLS connection. Now, we had to do some math kung fu with this because not every single appliance reporting in has TLS decryption disabled. But basically, once you pull it out into the appliances that have this feature enabled, it was 67% of the threats we saw came in over a HTTPS connection, which is pretty substantial, and I think it deserves some expanding on.
That's over two-thirds.
Yeah.
I guess just by a little, but still. And by the way, it's no surprise TLS is taken off. Listeners, you've probably figured it out by now, but that's kind of the namesake of our podcast you're listening to right now. But this, I think, is a hugely relevant data. And to be honest, you know, Mark mentioned we've been waiting a long time to show this, but just not enough people turn it on. And this was the first time it came to statistically relevant. That said, we haven't shared the percentage of how many turn it on because it's still really low. So if you're not using TLS decryption, you really ought to. You're missing a lot, at least from a network level. I will say, we believe you need network TLS decryption too, but obviously endpoint security can help fill in that gap a little. Anything that arrives at the endpoint, it's of course the traffic gets decrypted there and that security service probably sees it. But just remember how much stuff evades the endpoint as well. So it's better to filter as much as you can before you get there. So if you learn anything from me and Mark today, if you have a device that does TLS decryption well, you should definitely use it.
Yeah, and we always preach every single day having a layered security approach. You don't want to rely on your endpoint agent being able to catch these threats as they arrive on the endpoint and potentially execute. Having a layered approach, which means also inspecting it at the network perimeter before it even reaches the endpoint, is basically critical.
Yep.
And so it was 67% of threats came in over a TLS connection. When we look at that zero-day malware number we mentioned earlier, specifically for TLS encrypted threats, it jumps up to 72%. So like Corey mentioned, malware can be evasive. And in this case, the ones that came in over an encrypted connection, meaning potentially just bypassing your perimeter detections entirely, were, on the whole, more evasive than the non-encrypted payloads.
And anecdotally, it makes sense, right? If you're an attacker that already understands the value of encrypting your attack, meaning the potential to bypass security, you probably are a more sophisticated attacker in general. So you would also take other precautions to bypass security, including doing things to kind of help your malware evade malware detection.
Yep.
So, yeah. And by the way, that also means if you're not using HTTPS, just realize that, you know, we're missing a lot of the malware that's coming to Fireboxes that don't have HTTPS enabled. So all those numbers could be way higher simply because you don't know what you're missing.
Yeah. And I get it. Like, it has historically been more work to enable HTTPS decryption. You have to mess with certificates. But these days, like for us specifically, and I'm sure for even some of our other competitors out there, there is like a well-documented way to enable these features and help protect your clients. It's definitely not as difficult as it used to be.
And then more importantly, some of the old ways we recommended, which were probably focusing on individual clients, have now changed to focusing on an infrastructure certificate, which actually makes it way easier as long as you have that infrastructure.
Like, I will say, if you have all of your computers joined to a Microsoft Active Directory domain, you really don't have much of an excuse not to enable TLS decryption, because it's really easy to piggyback off of that PKI infrastructure. Private key infrastructure. It's like an ATM machine.
I know. But saying PKI without the infrastructure seems weird, even though it's technically accurate. It's one of those weird English things.
What was I saying? So it's really easy to piggyback off of your PK infrastructure and basically sign a certificate and import it back into the Firebox, and all of those domain joined computers will automatically trust it, and you won't get cert warnings all over the place. So take a look at it. If you're a WatchGuard customer, take a look at our documentation. We've made a lot of improvements to the TLS decryption portion of them, even in just the last couple of years, even with tips on setting up your own PKI if you don't have Microsoft Active Directory. It is absolutely worth it because of the percentage of threats that you're potentially missing.
And to add to easy, even down to exceptions. I mean, there are some cases where you may not want it, but we've actually have some exception defaults. So if you haven't looked at it for a long time, as Mark said, a lot of the configuration has been simplified, and things like exceptions are a little more baked in, so you don't have to worry about one-off problems.
Yep. So we went over a few individual threats that were new in the top 10, or at least interesting for the quarter in the report. We won't go into all of them here on the podcast, but there were a couple that we want to point out. There was only one new addition to the top 10 for this quarter when compared to previous quarters. And it was, I wouldn't say it's like, you know, a super malicious payload, but it's more of a grayware tool that really popped up. And it's our signature for it was called Flawed AMI. And it's basically this AMI act, like this remote access tool that's kind of grayware. Like, it's been historically packaged with a bunch of grayware tools, maybe adware, things that you generally wouldn't want on your computer, just as a way to monetize it because it is a free remote access tool. But it's also commonly used in tech support scams as well, where you'll get a call from someone claiming to be from Microsoft, for example, saying you have malware on your computer, and help enable remote access for them to hop in and clean up that malware and know they're totally not going to drop a Trojan on there too. So in the report, we went over this particular tool and why we think it spiked up. Corey, looks like you want to say something.
I was just going to say, and other things that have given this a bad reputation from the security community, I think the website itself and the infrastructure that distributes it has had numbers of vulnerabilities and maybe even breaches. And it's the tool itself has kind of had a high number of vulnerabilities, which not isn't necessarily horrible, but it seems pretty... let's call it unprofessional the way the tool is made. And I also think early versions of the tool didn't even have basic security features that most remote desktop products have, such as passwords and stuff. That I think has changed now a little, but long story short, it's bad enough that almost every AV vendor kind of tags this as grayware, despite the fact that it does have some legitimate purposes too.
Yep.
I'd kind of, and this is an addition I'm doing now, but VNC, I actually think VNC is more legitimate and has a better reputation, but to be quite honest, VNC kind of is in a similar bucket in that it's often used by malware actors. There's plenty of frameworks, including the public pentest frameworks, you know, that literally work VNC's server DLL directly into their stagers and payloads. So it's not uncommon for these legitimate tools to be used for this purpose. So it's good to see them.
Yep. We also highlighted another threat that isn't really new to the report in general. It's a Trojan called Crixos. But this quarter, we found some payloads that were kind of interesting and highlighted a specific variant of this Trojan. If you're not familiar with Crixos, we go over it pretty in detail in the report. But basically, it comes in as an email that's disguised as an invoice. And it's got an attachment that is actually an HTML file. So it's not a binary executable. It's not a Word document. It's an HTML file. So if you open it, it looks like you've gone to a website. And then it prompts you to enter your Office 365 or Google Docs login information to gain access to this document that they're quote unquote trying to share with you. And as you might guess, if you put in your credentials in there, it's not going to give you access to any document. Instead, it sends them off to a WordPress site, potentially just a compromised site that the attacker got a hold of, or maybe just a fake front end set up to hide the endpoint where they're harvesting these credentials. And this is pretty par for the course these days when it comes to phishing attacks. I'd say most of the ones that we see, just if I were to say offhand, through our DNS watch service, they tend to be attempts to steal credentials where they'll say they're trying to share a document with you. Sometimes they are really good at disguising their tracks, like they'll host it on a valid Microsoft-owned domain, like they'll register their own subdomain off of the Azure cloud. And they'll put up a form that makes it look like you're trying to log into Office 365, but in reality, you're just giving your credentials straight to the attacker. These types of threats are easier to mitigate, though, by using things like multi-factor authentication, where That way, even if you give up your credentials, the attacker is not able to get straight into your account without stealing your phone, basically. So moving on, next up was the network attack section, where we go over the intrusion prevention service detections for the quarter. This one has historically, it doesn't, like, their top 10 list doesn't actually change a whole lot quarter to quarter. Like, the same 10 or 9 threats are almost always there, maybe reordered in terms of how many detections each one individually got. It was pretty much the same this quarter as well. I will say one of the top threats that we saw, which was a SQL injection signature, accounted for 36% of all the network detections we saw in the quarter, which is pretty nuts. But basically, quarter over quarter, we were slightly down in terms of network attack detections. Year over year, it was slightly up. One highlight that we did point out in the report is that just about all of the top 10 threats and all of the top most widespread threats, so the threats affecting the most individual networks, are really easily scriptable. And so we're kind of attributing them to automated tools out there that are scanning the internet, looking for potentially vulnerable services that are exposed out there. And these days, it's easier than ever for an attacker to find those services. There's tools like Shodan, which we've mentioned a few times on the podcast. Basically, a Google for IoT is what they call it, but it's really a Google for any network exposed service that fingerprints whatever you have exposed and allows attackers to find potential targets. And it's easy these days to spin up a server and go scan the whole internet too.
From a malware perspective too, these mass scan commands or features are like their default in botnet. If any listeners have been with WatchGuard for over a decade, I have really old botnet malware analysis videos on YouTube. I'm embarrassed to watch them now, but they actually have good information. But you see me use a mass scan command from ZBot, which is very similar to Citadel. And all the mass scan command is it randomly goes through IPv4 space and it grabs the exploit library that it knows about. And as soon as it sees, oh, I found an open SMB port, I'm going to try these 5 SMB flaws. You know, the majority of them might be 2-year-old flaws with only one new one, but it doesn't matter. If you're scanning the whole IP space, you tend to find victims. So all of these botnets and malware web exploit frameworks sold on the internet, simply, you know, part of their service is selling annual subscriptions to the latest exploit packs. And as Mark said, the scriptability, the fact that they literally are built in as a command in the botnet, just makes it trivial. You know, most botnet scripts, the first thing it does after infecting you and calling home is maybe perhaps starting something like a mass scan to start recruiting new victims from your new victim.
Yeah, another good example of that is like the Mirai botnet, where it wasn't actually trying to exploit anything, but as soon as it infected a host, it would spin up a service on there and from that infected device, try and find other exposed open telnet ports out on the internet, then try and log into them. It's pretty common for botnets. That's basically how they spread these days. And so in the case of this network attack section, we saw a whole lot of automated attacks, things like SQL injection or cross-site scripting attempts. There were a few new ones, or not new ones, but a few client-related ones, like the one Corey mentioned earlier. One's targeting, for example, Adobe and how it handles opening potentially malicious PDFs, for example. I think it was like a 3-year-old or 2.5-year-old vulnerability in there that we saw in the number 10 slot. But even that one wasn't new. It had shown up in previous reports as well.
And I will say one thing we do see heavily in network attacks, though, is not only are they all web-based in some sense, even this Adobe one is typically the PDF files coming over a web client connection. It is heavy web application too. And remember, web application flaws, while they're still network exploits and you can have signatures for them, they're not vulnerabilities in a certain software package necessarily. They're just more flaws in your own code in some cases. So SQL injection while we had a new signature of it, you know, last quarter we had a heavy amount of SQL injection. This quarter, as Mark mentioned, it's still way up there. So one of the takeaways we keep on saying, I think, in the network attacks is get your developers to know OWASP.org inside out, the Open Web Application Security Project.
Yep, good takeaway. The last bit in the Firebox feed section was our DNS analysis, where we look at three main categories of domains. malware domains, compromised websites, and phishing domains. So malware is typically domains or websites associated with command and control servers or distributing malware. Compromised websites are traditionally good, legitimate websites that an attacker has taken over or exploited a flaw on them or just exploited their service in order to carry out some form of attack. And then phishing domains, as you might guess, are websites and domains associated with phishing attempts. So in the report, we started out with looking at the top 10 malware domains in terms of detections. It was actually really interesting this quarter. There were only two domains that carried over from previous reports. The other eight were entirely brand new for the quarter. The two that carried over were two CloudFront.net subdomains. So like I mentioned earlier, attackers that are abusing legitimate services and registering subdomains on them to host their malware. But outside that, the new eight ones, they were all kind of interesting. So the top one was this domain called BellSysCDN, which, by the way, don't go to any of these. They're all malicious domains. But it was responsible for over half of all of our malware domain blocks for the quarter. And our analyst who was looking into this section found that it was associated as a command and control server for the Bondat worm, which, among many other features like attacking WordPress websites, it also includes Monero crypto mining features as well. And we talked about this a few years ago when all the cryptocurrencies were really spiking in value. And it seemed like almost every Trojan we were finding, attackers were adding crypto miner modules to them just as a way to earn a couple extra bucks. And even though the crypto markets have kind of crashed or at least stabilized since then, it's basically free money for an attacker that's able to infect a system. Even if they're only earning a fraction of a cent per infection per day, it adds up eventually.
I agree. Even when Bitcoin was in the 1,000 range, one of the things, if you just want to know how many different ways they try to monetize, one of the first things a botnet does is they tend to have modules that just steal your keys. So they basically go through the Windows registry to try to find software keys that they can somehow reuse or sell to get people, legitimate seeming versions of pirated software. So even if Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency is down, like you said, it's just a free thing. If you already have a botnet on someone's computer, you're already monetizing it by DDoSing. You've stolen all the keys. You've stolen all the information. Why not throw a crypto miner on there too? Doesn't hurt you. You're just the attacker taking advantage.
Yep. The good news is that another network security company called Anubis Networks actually took control of the command and control infrastructure for the Bondat worm kind of recently. That doesn't stop currently infected devices from still trying to phone home, but it does tend to, in most cases, at least neuter their functionality. But the fact that it still showed up as our number one detection with so many detections kind of goes to show how widespread this botnet was. Even though its command and control system's been taken down.
More importantly, and I don't think we actually mentioned this in the report or even in, we recently did a webinar presentation on this report, but we're getting these DNS watch hits because clients under Firebox protection are making calls to these CNCs. So as an admin, obviously the benefit of DNS watch and even other capabilities, we just call it botnet control, which detects and blocks a lot of the botnet IPs as well. But you should be monitoring, our Firebox is blocking it. It's not letting infected victims get to the command and control, which is going to help them a little, but you still have an affected computer in your network. So one practical takeaway is obviously there are Firebox owners out there that have some computers that are beaconing out. So check your DNS watch logs, check your botnet control logs, and look at them. Look at the IPs that are actually being hit repeatedly. Yes, we're doing our job in protecting you from getting there, but you probably have a computer you need to go disinfect.
Yep, if you've got WatchGuard Cloud Visibility or Dimension, I think it's the security dashboard or at least the executive dashboard, each will show your security services, what they're blocking. And in this case, both botnet detection will show up in there. DNS watch is through its own separate portal for now, though, too. But yes, you should be watching monitoring all of your security services to identify potentially infected hosts that even though we're protecting you from them connecting to command and control infrastructure, you still should go clean them up.
Yeah, a lot of people think of us more as preventative, which is true, but remember that these can also be indicators of something you have to do. Although hopefully you have TDR too, which has an endpoint client, and we can automate some of that remediation for you if you use TDR.
Yep. So outside that top domain, five of the other new domains for the malware domain list were also involved in Monero crypto mining campaigns. Two of them were part of the Reddit Up Trojan, and three of them were part of the PhotoMiner worm as well. So a lot of crypto mining going on this quarter. I think this is the most individual domains associated with crypto mining, period, not just Monero mining, that we've seen in a single quarter, which is interesting in my opinion, because cryptocurrency is still in a bit of like a, I won't say rut, but it's not as popular as it was several years ago. But it can still earn attackers money, which is why we're seeing it show up in these Trojans and worms.
My feeling is cryptocurrency is cyclical. I'm sure we'll see it hit a high again soon one day. We've gone through decades of it being, oh, this is worthless, to, oh, wow, this is worth something, to, oh, this is down. Oh, wait a second, this is worth something. So I have a feeling crypto mining will not be going away for quite a long time.
Most likely not. The last two new domains in the malware domain list were, one of them was passportinfo.info, which, as you might guess, was designed to look like a legitimate website for U.S. passports and information on them. But in reality, it was hosting a Trojan that goes and tries to change your DNS settings, which is actually pretty dangerous for clients. If an attacker can change your DNS server or redirect your DNS queries to something under their control, it makes it much more easy for them to man-in-the-middle connections, any connection that you make out to the internet. Your browser does include some protections for this, like Chrome, Firefox, most of them have HSTS or HTTP strict transport security enabled by default, which basically means that if there is any issue at all whatsoever with the certificate for a website that you go and visit, it'll block that connection and not allow you to get past the block. So for example, if an attacker can hijack your DNS, they're not going to be able to man in the middle you going to gmail.com, just because that is by default in Chrome and even Firefox a part of the HSTS list. But there are plenty of other sites that they could potentially man in the middle and steal your credentials out of, or inject more malicious JavaScript into your connections too. So it's pretty dangerous to be messing around with the DNS in this case.
Yeah, if you can hijack any connection, just the fact that you can inject JavaScript means that you can use JavaScript to install man-in-the-browser attacks or other things just when people visit any site. You know, I won't name the image that was replaced, but when people were first showing DEFCON man-in-the-middle injection, one of the first things they did is just created a star rule for any domain that if you went to it, the script would pop in, and every image on the website you were visiting would replace to a specific image of their choice. In this case, was an image you can't unsee and you probably don't want to see in the first place.
I believe it was Lemon Party, yeah. Right?
You went where I was trying to avoid, but you're exactly, yes.
Don't go looking that up.
No.
Do not go looking
meme,
that up.
But DEFCON forced that meme on me.
Yep. So when it came to the compromised websites, back to the report, Corey, there were actually no new additions this quarter, which is a first for that. There were still plenty of threats in there that we blocked from compromised websites. It was just ones that we had seen and highlighted previously in other reports. In the phishing domains, though, we had three brand new ones for this quarter, too. The first one was cook.shortestroute.com, which targeted customers of a very specific niche application. So there's a company out there called Map, M-A-P-P, and they've got a tool called Engage, which is basically an analytical platform for finding and interfacing with customers. You described this much more eloquently than I did, Corey, in the last...
Neither of us have used it before. So to be quite honest, we didn't know much about what MapEngage was until our report.
Yeah.
And this phishing attempt.
Yeah.
They must be doing something, right? Because they're a target.
Yeah. So this specific phish was designed to go after customers that use MapEngage, which, like Corey said, I had never heard of it before either. So it's a pretty niche phishing attack, and interesting that it showed up in our top 10 list. Another one that we had show up in there was hateyou.com. which was designed to look like Bet365, which if you watch Premier League Soccer, you're probably very familiar with. It's a Chinese-based sports betting website, basically. And so this fish, like the destination
was all... So were you familiar with, Mr. Soccer fan, do you bet on Chinese teams too?
No, but I think they sponsor several clubs. I think it's like Newcastle and like a few others as well. They are literally everywhere in advertisements. If you haven't watched Premier League Soccer, almost every team is sponsored by some random sports betting place. And the other ones are sponsored by, what is it, Arsenal sponsored by Visit Rwanda, which is kind of interesting. No, my favorite is Everton, who have a patch for Angry Birds on their shirt. They're sponsored by Angry Birds. So
that's a fun one.
Yeah. anyways, this fish was all in Chinese. So if you received it and you weren't a Chinese national or someone that spoke it, it's pretty obvious that it was a fish in that case. One takeaway I had from this, though, was the domain has no similarities to Bet365. And a few of these in the phishing list, like what they were spoofing, had no relation to the domain itself. So if you just pay attention to the domains you're clicking on or going to, it's a big red flag in a lot of these cases for that is potentially malicious.
This is just real-time anecdotal querying. But do you think often these sorts of phishing or even malware campaigns can go through a lot of redirects? Mm-hmm. So do you think they might have an original domain that might look closer and maybe it goes through a number of redirects? One reason for it could be, you know, obviously people are trying to take down bad domains as quickly as they come up. So it could be that this wasn't the direct domain that started the whole phishing attempt. It just happened to be the one that it eventually redirected to.
True. Yeah.
Who knows?
That is entirely possible.
Either way, it should, by the time you get to the site that you see something, this is the domain that would appear in your URL bar. So
also,
still an opportunity to see it.
If you see your browser flicker for 15 seconds as it goes through a redirection wormhole, that's another sign that whatever you're doing is probably a little bit sketchy too.
I don't know. I've seen some pretty subtle redirects that you don't even notice them.
Fair.
And most people don't realize that every site they go to, you're probably visiting 50 domains by the time that site page is loaded.
That is true. I will say sometime, like, open up like your browser's dev tools, go to the network section and then refresh whatever page you're on and be amazed at all the crap that it loads in the background.
Yep.
The final new domain in there, secure.counterpath.com, was no longer active at the time we were investigating it for the report, but it was previously hosting a phishing campaign that was impersonating an AT&T login. So again, could have been redirects going to it, but either way, the end domain had really nothing to do with what it was trying to impersonate. Most of these domains were designed, or these phishing attacks were designed to try and steal credentials from users. So just be mindful of where you're entering your username and password for. If you get a email with someone trying to share a document, treat that with absolute skepticism. Go and confirm it out of band. So shoot them a text message or a Teams message or a Skype phone call or something, and just confirm before you go willingly give up your username and password.
By the way, I want to give an anti-tip, because it's a tip that even security professionals like us probably gave 3 or 4 years ago. We used to always, when we're trying to tell you to check if you're at the right place, we used to always say, look for the green lock in the HTTPS connection. I want to point out that you might notice we never give that tip anymore. And it's simply because of the fact that everyone has moved to TLS encryption. And with organizations like Let's Encrypt, which, by the way, we don't think is a bad organization at all. We like what they're doing, but it kind of lowers the bar to creating a secure website. So what I'm getting at is just being the fact that it shows a lock is no longer any sort of, you know, it might be a validation that the URL you're going to is really that URL, but it's not a validation of security, because a lot of these malware sites use secure connections too, as probably should be obvious based on the TLS number we reported earlier, how much malware comes over TLS.
Yeah, and even hovering over the link is no longer a guarantee of the legitimacy of the destination, too. Like, even if it says Microsoft.com or AWS.com or whatever, that doesn't mean it's something that company put up. Because these days with cloud hosting, you can basically put whatever you want up on the internet and pray off that domain's reputation.
Everyone can have a SharePoint domain at this point.
Yeah. So our main takeaways for the Firebox feed section, we had three bullet points at the end of the report. First one was TLS inspection is necessary. Like we mentioned, 67% of the threats that we saw in the quarter, once you extrapolate it out, came over a TLS connection that had to be decrypted in order to detect that threat. And so if you haven't gone through an enabled TLS inspection, you are missing a lot of threats that are out there and basically leaving it up to your endpoint security to try and catch it. So it's well worth the time to go enable TLS decryption. It's easier now than ever. And depending on whether you're a WatchGuard customer or not, the performance impact isn't as bad as you might think it is either. Next up was use a layered defense. Like I said, we preach this, I feel like, every single episode that we ever do of this podcast, because you basically don't want to rely on one tool to try and catch whatever malware or attack is coming through. There's no silver bullet when it comes to security. You need multiple layers so that if one of them fails, you have another one to back it up. And that should also include detection and response tools as well, because like Corey mentioned earlier, nothing's perfect, and eventually something might slip through the cracks or come in through like a USB key onto a computer, and you need tools to be able to detect those threats before they're able to become a serious incident as well. And then finally, block command and control channels. This basically boils down to there's a chance your endpoint might become infected and be added to a botnet, but if you can block that communication to the command and control server, even though it's technically infected, you can tend to limit the amount of damage that it's able to do, or at least limit whatever new modules or spreading that it can do as well.
Yeah. To be fair, Mark uses the term limit carefully because it all depends on the malware. Some malware is designed to immediately programmatically do something bad, whereas other malware might actually need the command and control channel before it does anything. This even comes down to ransomware. Some early ransomware actually couldn't encrypt your files until it reached the command and control because it had to set up a public key and the server had a public private key pair and the server had to be aware of that. I will say though, the one side effect to this is there is other ransomware that does locally generate a public private key pair, and so it will encrypt your files, but blocking a command and control channel actually means they don't have the private key. So there's
well, you can't win them all.
I won't go into more detail there. But the point is, some malware might still be able to do something kind of bad, but I guarantee you blocking the command and control channel is going to limit its efficacy, the malware's efficacy. And the other tip we just want to add to this, besides blocking it, monitor those reports. Because if there's an IP that's regularly calling out to a command and control channel, you better be going to handle that to mitigate the infection or install TDR on it, and it will probably find the infection and then it can kill the processes. It can help you clean it up.
Exactly. So moving on, the last section of the report was our top security incident, which for quarter one, as you might have guessed, was COVID-19. And so in the report, we go into a bit more detail, but we basically describe how the threat landscape changed in just the first 3 months of this year. Like, this pandemic forced a pretty massive change of people from working behind a network perimeter in an office to primarily working remotely. And along with that came some new threats, or at least increased threats as well. So like to throw some of the stuff out there that we saw in the report, we highlighted that there was a pretty substantial increase in mobile VPN usage just from January through March. That was like an 8.3% increase across Firebox users, which did show that more people were working remotely. The good news is mobile VPN usage means that they are connecting back to the Firebox. And if they've zero routed that tunnel, as it's called, that means that they are then again benefiting from the perimeter detections of being behind the Firebox too, potentially. But along with working from home comes some more risks, like there's less face-to-face interaction, for example. Also, just the fact of the pandemic that's stressing everyone out, and we all want more information on it, kind of lowers our tipping point when it comes to phishing attacks. Makes it easier for an attacker to craft a phish that preys on our fears and our concerns and our stress and might get us to click on a link. So it leaves us more susceptible to phishes. And we highlighted some data like the Crixos malware that we mentioned earlier. We showed how it trended up through the quarter. Also, just insecure remote access deployments. So as you quickly tried to get people to work from home, maybe you didn't set up a VPN, maybe you just forwarded ports to whatever web apps you had behind the Firebox, which could also leave them open to brute force attempts from attackers. So we showed how brute force detections trended upward through the quarter as well. And basically the main takeaways for this section were just first off, increase your communication. So attackers are going to prey on the fact that you can't just walk around a corner to someone's office to confirm a wire transfer or request or that a Word document actually came from them. So you've got to find other ways to confirm what you receive via email while you're treating it all with skepticism as well. So shoot a Teams message, open up Skype, use GoToMeeting, whatever. Just double check everything and increase your communication. Also, it'll make you feel a little better too to see all your employees. Like I know personally, I love it when I hop on some of our meetings and like, you know, 15 of my coworkers are there that I haven't seen in several months. It's nice. Also, consider security.
Except when I join the meeting, then you see him cringe up pretty quickly.
Yeah, then the party's done. Also, consider security when you're setting up remote access. Like I totally get it. Like when this pandemic hit, it was like, at least in Washington state, it went from, oh, this is getting kind of bad. Maybe we'll have to make a plan to, oh crap, everyone has to work from home starting right now over the course of like 2 days. And I'm sure for a lot of organizations, there was a lot of pressure to quickly enable those people to work remotely. And you might have taken some shortcuts when it came to setting up that remote access. So now's the time to go back and review what you've done, maybe add some more security, use VPNs or clientless VPN access portals to protect your internal resources. Make sure you've set up network segmentation and implemented good authentication with multi-factor, for example, just to protect your users and your resources as they continue to work from home for the time being. And then also just take care of yourself. So increased stress and things like that tend to make you more susceptible to cyber threats. Like if you're stressed out and working too hard, you might miss a telltale red flag in a phishing message and fall for it. So take care of yourself, take a deep breath, maybe pour a martini or something and wait for it all to blow over, and it'll help you keep yourself more secure as well.
So why don't we, I think we covered everything, but why don't I like to summarize the big tips besides the one you gave. TLS, we said it over and over. If you have the option to decrypt TLS on your network devices, do it. Endpoint helps too. Continue to use proactive malware detection. That zero-day number we give you every quarter shows you that signature-based detection's not enough. You don't necessarily only have to use WatchGuard APT Blocker or Intelligent AV, because there's all kinds of products that use more proactive techniques, but look for behavioral analysis and some machine learning. You just gave the great example of keeping vigilant and taking care of yourself because of the tipping point. If you search for articles, an ex-CIA executive just talked about how COVID-19 has created the ideal crisis conditions for malicious hackers. And that's exactly what you were talking about, Mark. In a crisis, this is actually a great opportunity for threat actors because they can take advantage of the fear that goes with it. And again, as you're working from home, Mark mentioned that, you know, I believe this ex-CIA executive also mentioned that we moved really fast and we probably cut corners. It's time to go back and check those corners and fill in any gaps we might have created. And of course, don't forget WatchGuard now owns Panda Security. They're a part of our company, which we're very happy to have all those employees and their products. So AD360 can help you with your work at home needs too. It stands for Adaptive Defense 360, by the way.
Yep. So check out the reports, watchguard.com/security-report. You can also just pull up the 2-page or so executive summary if that's all you have time for. A lot of good information in there. And then if you take away only one thing from the entire report, it's the necessity of TLS inspection. You're missing far too many threats on your perimeter that you could be detecting and blocking if you haven't set up decryption yet. So I think that's a good enough place as any to end this one. That was a long podcast. Thank you, everyone who is still currently listening. And we'll see you around next week then. Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey is at @SecAdept. And the both of us are at #the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.